You're listening to Pod on the Cob, Episode 2. This week we're covering Signs from 2002, directed by M. Night Shyamalan. Enjoy! Welcome to Pod on the Cob. This is the podcast about movies and corn, and specifically movies with corn in them. My name is Tyler, and I'm here with my co-host,
Stephanie.
And we're going to be talking about Signs. I think if you want to know this background around why we have a podcast about corn and movies, listen to the first episode.
Yeah, and if you missed the first one, no big deal. You don't have to go in chronological order.
Yeah.
So if you're a fan of movies, you're in the right spot.
Definitely.
If you have a fleeting interest in corn, you're possibly in the right spot as well. Or no interest, to be honest. You don't. That's also not a prerequisite.
Yeah.
So yeah, stay tuned. We are talking about Signs.
Yeah, Signs. Stephanie, tell us about Signs. What's the story of Signs?
Before I jump right into the story, I do want to say at the top of the show that there will be spoilers. If that matters to you, then maybe hit pause and go and watch Signs and then come back and listen. If you don't, if it's whatever, then cool. But we're not saving any details. Nothing will be spared. Everything will be spoiled.
Yeah, we literally are going to do something a little different than the last episode, and we're going to just literally talk through the entire movie. There you have it.
Okay, so Signs, came out in 2002. It's got a great plot, I think. So after a very tragic death of a reverend's wife, he and his family start experiencing a series of very inexplicable and ominous events sparked by the discovery of crop circles in their cornfields and fearing for potentially the end of the world. This man, his brother, and his two young children have to navigate through grief and fear and all kinds of things in order to survive.
Beautifully put. I literally want to go through the entire story of the movie beat by beat. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about Signs, how it relates to my memories of it. I think that you said you have some stories you want to tell.
I do.
So this came out 3 years after The Sixth Sense. It came out 2 years after Unbreakable. I'm going to go a little bit into some of my memories of this. For me, I had seen both of those. I had really enjoyed both of those. I was a little child actor myself at the time. So I really liked Sixth Sense because it had Haley Joel Osment in it, and he was a little kid. And I really liked Unbreakable. I was really excited for Signs, but I didn't see it right when it came out. I saw it like after it was out of theaters. I started it with a friend, and we turned it off because we got too scared, too spooked. And then I bragged to Grady, my brother, that I saw it. And when we watched it with him, I like, kind of pretended like I'd seen the whole thing. But I think I had like read a Mad Magazine article about it, so I filled in a lot of gaps. So my history with it was like, I remember it being very scary. So that's my memory of it. What about you?
Okay. Mine's really different.
Okay.
So I'm a few years younger than you.
All right, don't brag.
So
no reason to brag.
I was, you're like middle school. I'm talking like early elementary. Like, the TV was always on in my house, and there wasn't a lot of, like, especially if my mom wasn't home, there wasn't a ton of, like, hey, don't watch this while I'm watching this. So I sort of, like, watched Signs with my dad in the living room and was terrified, shaking my boots. I think I was, like, glued to, like, I couldn't look away because I was so scared. I think it was my first scary movie, like, ever in my whole life. Which
it's a good first scary movie.
It's a good first scary movie because it's not, I wouldn't necessarily say it's like horror, but it's definitely frightening and like mysterious and ominous because I feel like there's just a lot of fear. The characters are afraid, people are afraid, like no one really knows what's going on, and that scared me shitless as a kid.
Totally. Yeah. I was doing a little bit of research on it, obviously getting ready for this, and it's not really considered a horror movie.
Yeah.
Which I guess surprised me. And then now that I think about it, it makes a little bit of sense. It's more of like a thriller
really a
or suspense movie.
Yeah.
Debatable, I guess. But like, in my opinion, like nothing horrific happens in it. It's fairly tame, but it's still scary.
It's scary.
And
it's unsettling.
Unsettling. That's a good word. And like Sixth Sense, I remembered being fucking terrified of the Sixth Sense. Like fucking terrified of it. And looking back, like that's also not really a horror movie, you know? So M. Night, I think he's an intriguing person and an intriguing director. I think with this movie, Sixth Sense, really solid. At least in my memory, it's really solid and pretty scary. Unbreakable is a kind of unique movie. And then this one, I think, is where we start to see him maybe start to get sloppy. But I still enjoyed watching this as a kid and now.
Yeah, same. And I'm sure, like, a lot of people have, especially our age, have a memory of watching Signs. Because I feel like Signs was... And those movies that you just mentioned were all very culturally significant.
Yes.
And maybe it's just like when we were, for us kids, like at the time, like it was like all the buzz, like coming into school and being like, I watch Signs, or I quoting, I see dead people.
Totally.
And shit like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure there's, I feel like movies are more fun too, or can be more fun when you have that sentimental memory of it.
Yeah. I think both of us agreed that we wanted to kick this episode off talking about our history with this because we have a history with it. And as fun as Children of the Corn was, I might have a childhood history of it with it to some degree, but it didn't come out when I was a kid. So it was just some old movie.
Totally.
This, for you and I came out in our lifetime when we were kids, and it has this, there's a sentimentality I have toward it, a softness, like there's a fondness I have toward it a little bit.
Yeah. So kind of segueing too, I think the reason why it was so big is like some of these big actors, I mean, Mel Gibson is
totally
the lead, and he had done like a few, like, he was a big name at the time.
He was
even
huge
for us as a kid. I mean, there's other big names for sure, but I would say I didn't know who they were when I was young, but Mel Gibson was definitely recognizable. As an adult watching it back, I know all the leads.
Yeah, they're all
Joaquin
famous
Phoenix
now. Yeah,
who plays Merrill, the little brother of Mel Gibson's character, whose name is Reverend Graham Hess. Well, actually, he's a retired reverend.
Yeah, he says
that's
many
point
times in the
movie. That's a point in the movie, a big point. People are calling him father, and he's like, I'm not your father.
One of my biggest issues with this movie was the awkward tonal shifts in it. Like him reminding people that he's not a father anymore. Is in the sense of being like a reverend,
totally.
It ties to a lot of some of the more awkward, like, tonal shift scenes. But yeah, big actors in this.
They're played.
Rory Culkin is the son. His name is
Morgan.
And yes, because the daughter's name is Bo.
Abigail Breslin.
Yes.
Abigail Breslin is like Little Miss Sunshine, Zombieland. As she's older, I think she's my age. So she's probably like 7 in this movie.
Yeah.
She's little and she's really cute. Well, she looks like a little doll.
We're coming hot off of a movie that stars a bunch of kids. And our biggest thing we hated about that movie was how bad the kids were.
Yes. And I love that. I love that we get to redeem child acting.
Because they're great. Because They're both great. Rory Culkin is especially good and really mesmerizing and haunting.
Yeah.
I thought he was really good.
He does an amazing job. And I will say, like, of all the Culkin siblings, like, you know, looking at all the other things he's been in, I didn't really recognize, like, a lot of the stuff he's been in.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I'm pumped that he's in this and that he's amazing.
He's really good. And she's great as well.
Yeah.
Ironically, I think Joaquin Phoenix is one of the greatest actors alive. I'm a big Joaquin Phoenix fan. I'll defend him for the most part in almost anything. I hated him in this, and I didn't really think And I'm not just blaming the character. I didn't like the character at all. But I actually just didn't, for the most part, I wasn't really super into Joaquin in this.
You didn't like his performance.
I thought he was fine. I shouldn't say hated. I thought he was fine. I really disliked the character.
And he's coming, like, hot off Gladiator? Or is this before Gladiator?
He's coming hot off of Gladiator.
He's coming hot off of Gladiator.
And again, it might be the character, and he might just be doing his best with the character. Mel Gibson is good in this. Mel Gibson, I think he's really good. He's really haunting. Mel Gibson, obviously, famously Catholic. He obviously is a man of faith, that's how he portrays himself. And I think maybe the role resonated with him.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, again, he's like a big shot actor. But he also, going back to what you were saying, represents that, like, middle American, like, white, well-to-do. Like, they live in a really beautiful home.
Yeah.
And, like, they seem fine. They're not struggling. It's very representative of, like, the American dream, if you will.
Yeah.
His character.
Yeah, it's a little unclear what they, since he's not a reverend,
yeah.
Are they actually farmers?
I kept asking, I watched this with my husband, Chris. I kept asking, like, so wait, are they farmers?
Yeah.
Because, like, you don't see them farm at all.
Totally.
But they live clearly on a farm.
With cornfields, which is why we're talking about the movie in the first place.
The
star of the movie is the corn. I will say, let's just get this out of the way because it's uncomfortable. It's the monkey in the room. Mel Gibson, kind of scumbag.
Yeah.
I don't like him as a person.
Yeah.
I think he does a good job in this movie. I'm not in any way, like, trying to throw any credence toward his views or who he is as a person.
Yeah, absolutely not.
I think as a performance, I think he's pretty good in this. I guess I just want to get that out of the way. I don't want you to think that we're, like glazing this guy.
No, he fucking sucks. No. Yeah.
I'm going to say a big cliche about M. Night right off the bat, which is M. Night famously is compared to Alfred Hitchcock, and he is. Yeah,
I'm making a extremely shocked face.
This is a famous comparison, and
Hitchcock,
and okay. right off the bat,
who I love, by the way, or the movies. Same. I don't really know much about them.
Also a famous scumbag,
but
we can like his movies.
Okay,
but I will say right from the get go, opening credits are incredibly Hitchcockian.
That's true.
First off, we get an opening credits that shows all of these different roles in the movie, which is rare. Like, in this era, it's rare to get, like, the full credits at the start. Not the full credits, but we get, like, a lot of the credits.
But you definitely get, like, the main build actors and the producers and the director.
And it's over a, like, like, violin.
Full orchestra.
It feels like you're watching the start of a movie from, like, the 50s or
the
60s.
Yes. Which I do think adds, like, an element of charm and sort of, like, improves the moviegoer's experience, where you can feel, like, drawn into this film. A pretty epic soundtrack so far, like, right away.
Yeah. It evokes feelings of an older movie. I was looking at some of the things that people didn't like about Signs online, and a lot of it's, like, stuff to me that if you pretend like the movie was made in the 50s or made in the 60s, they're a little bit more excusable. Like, for example, and there's a lot of exposition in this movie. There's a lot of people giving you exposition, like news reporters telling you what's going on. But, like, in your brain, make the movie black and white and pretend like you're watching, like, a Hitchcock movie. And that stuff's kind of, like, you wouldn't care as much.
Yeah.
And I think that's what he's going for. It doesn't always work. And I'm going to, as we go through the story, I'll talk about examples of where it really doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
But,
well, I can say, so right after the credits or whatever and that great song, I was very pleased to find that Korn is the opening scene. Just Korn, center stage, stalks of corn, beautiful deep green.
I wrote it right here in my notes.
So did I.
Love the intro, immediate corn. Not only is corn immediately in the movie, but I would argue that as corn slowly exits the movie, it gets worse. The movie gets worse as you see less corn, in my opinion. But maybe we'll have differing opinions on that as we get there. But
yeah
immediate corn.
Corn is prominently featured.
I love the intro. I love Mel Gibson wakes up and immediately the movie starts with paranoia and panic.
Yep.
And it doesn't really ever go away, which is wonderful.
I love that because it adds to, like, the suspense. And it being unsettling is that you don't know what we're paranoid about. You don't know what we're afraid of. He wakes up. Why is he waking up in a panic?
Yeah.
Like, we don't really know much right away.
Yeah, as a viewer, you're sort of thrust into the story with him.
Yes.
And
I like that.
I love that entire opening sequence of him running through the cornfields and finding, of course, the namesake of the movie. They find the first sign,
which is
crop circle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Crop circles.
Yeah. And it's great. You have this frantic pace leading up to it. He's running through the cornfield. It's very frantic. And then the movie comes to this stop.
Yeah.
And it slowly zooms out to show you this gigantic crop circle in the middle of their cornfield. It's great. Like the pacing at the very, I actually like the pacing in this movie pretty much throughout.
Yeah. And it's nice because right at the beginning, that's when they introduce his family.
Mm-hmm.
So brother wakes up, Joaquin Phoenix, his character wakes up, runs out. They're like, what's happening? Right away, they're sprinting full speed through the corn. Finding their kids. Did the kids sleepwalk? Did they hear something? Right away, it's like question marks. Like, what? Why are we out here? What's going on? And it's freaky.
So this leads us to one of my favorite things about Signs and one of my least favorite things about Signs. Signs does a great job of delivering some exposition in a really unique way. I love the scene of him like crouching down, talking to his kids in the cornfield, not even noticing what they're observing, the crop circles, and then the way that they draw his attention to it. There's a lot of great scenes of that.
I love that Rory Culkin's character grabs his dad's face. He's like talking to him, and he literally physically turns his dad's head to look at what they're looking at because he hasn't even noticed it yet.
It's wonderful.
I thought that was like really well done, especially
me too.
For a little kid. I'm like, that's awesome. I mean, I'm sure he was given direction, but whatever. It was well done.
He does it really well. And there's a lot of scenes, as we talk about the story, there's a lot of scenes like that in the movie where the kids are kind of like delivering exposition in a way that's very scary, frankly, like scary, like chilling. But then we're following up with the scene with the sheriff, and then she just goes on a ridiculous exposition dump.
Yeah, it's true. But they call her to come and report the crime of the crop circle. At the point of the discovery of the crop circle, they don't know what's happened. They think it's just like they've been vandalized or whatever. They've been punked by the neighbors. They're not really sure what happened. So they call the cop. And it's like small town sheriff. I loved that the sheriff was a woman. She was sweet, especially to the kids. Once the sheriff comes in, we find out that the kid's mom and Mel Gibson's character's wife has died. We don't know how. We don't know anything about that yet. So it's kind of like what you're saying. We find out all this stuff because she literally just tells us.
She tells us, and she also tells us, and this is my least favorite, maybe part of the, possibly in the whole movie, other than the very, very end, but she says, all of the animals in the town are acting strange. It's like there's predators in the town. It's kind of like, dude, whoa. But again, as much as I didn't like that part, if the scene was black and white and I was watching a movie from the 50s, would I mind that as much? It feels very reminiscent of like an old thriller. So it bugged me a little bit, but it's not like the biggest sin ever.
Yeah, it didn't take me too far out of it. And I appreciated being informed.
It's nice to be informed.
It's nice to know, you know, where's the mom? Oh. Okay, dead. So like right after that, she talks about the animals in town being weird and like getting aggressive.
Yes.
A little bit later, you know, the sheriff leaves or whatever, and we hear like the kids scream. And so Graham comes running and sees their family dog dead in front of his son. So played by Rory Culkin. He was stabbed with a barbecue, like the barbecue fork.
It's like a skewer.
What do you call those?
Yeah, I don't know what you call it either. It's a two-pronged fork that you use in your barbecuing.
Yeah,
and
but the little boy killed the dog. It's obvious because it's stabbed. The little boy's squatting over the dead dog, and the little girl, the sister, is like up in their little treehouse or in their like little play jungle gym. The dad asked them like, "What happened?" And he's like, "He was trying to attack the little girl, so he had to defend his sister."
And thus begins a horrible trend in Pod on the Cob, a trend that neither Steph or myself are proud of. But this is the second movie in a row that we've watched for Pod on the Cob where a dog has died. I regret to inform our listeners that this will not be the first dog death in Signs. There is another dog
Sadly.
Death later on.
We are both proud dog parents.
We love our dogs.
We love our dogs.
Yes, very much.
But yes, this did happen. There were two dogs. So on this like farm, they had two dogs. The other dog was like barking its head off. And it was, they ordered the brother to go tie him up, get him out of here. Dogs can't be attacking our kids.
No. It's not like super clear why the dog would attack the kids because she's not an alien.
No.
But, yeah.
And like, I think the dogs found the crop circles first. And they were barking in that scene where we see the crop circles. It like pans out. The dogs are barking like crazy and running around those crop circles. Did something cause them to be aggressive?
I think what the movie's trying to tell us is that like the aliens being around is like they know the aliens are around and they're becoming aggressive because of that. And obviously, like, we should say that Mel Gibson and his family at this point, they just think it's a prank. They think it's a prank. They think some local kids did this. So then that segues us into the nighttime, right?
We look out the window and see a figure.
Yeah.
On a roof.
That scene as a kid scared the shit out of me. It's still scary. It's really great because a modern day movie would have done it with a lot less subtlety. And I really love the way that Signs, the thing is just standing there staring at them. It's scary.
It's pretty scary. And it's very like humanoid. And later on when they're describing this to the cop, they keep saying like it was dark. I, for one, can get scared when I see like shadows and figures and stuff, and my brain will invent like freaky things. So I could see how you would try to rationalize like seeing this figure on your roof. And people, that they're not in a town, they're in the middle of like cornfields,
right?
And it's the roof of like their barn. It's not like they're in a city and they're looking out and there's people on a roof or whatever. There shouldn't be a person on that roof. And they look out their window and there's something on the roof.
So they run out. They think it's a kid or they think it's a teenager.
Or the neighbor.
They think they're getting
whatever.
Pranked. Yeah. And Joaquin Phoenix. And they don't catch whatever.
No, they don't catch.
They don't catch whatever it is. It's jumping around. It's like getting away from them. And that this leads to, it's like the awkward dialogue Olympics happen. Because then the next scene is another scene with the sheriff. Cherry Jones, she comes over because, of course, they're like these teenagers are they were there at our house last night
again,
and they're talking about how athletic the people who are doing the prank must be because
oh my
they
God.
Were like,
okay.
And then you know where I'm going with this.
Yes,
the Joaquin Phoenix is convinced.
Fucking Meryl, dude.
Oh my God, Joaquin Phoenix's character is convinced that it could not be a woman.
He's such a dick.
And it makes it impossible to like him for me later on.
And he gets worse. But this kind of just shows it all, puts it all on the table.
And Cherry Jones, who is a sheriff, I'm sure that in oh earlier God. Stages of her career, she had to be incredibly physically able to do all kinds of things because she was a cop, right? She is
sure.
a cop. Her comparison she makes to prove that it might be a woman.
Oh my God, it's just as problematic.
Is, well, what if there are women in the Olympics that are good at things? So maybe this person could be an Olympian. It's such a weird scene, dude. Like, it's so awkward.
It is really awkward. You're right. Even the lines are awkwardly delivered. The actors don't believe what they're saying.
It's M. Night has... Okay, so this podcast started with a Stephen King adaptation. We started with Children of the Corn.
Yes.
And I always think that Stephen King is a great storyteller and he's like a good writer. I think some of his writing is
a little
sloppy.
Yeah, well, he writes novels, you know.
Yeah, but for me, I think M. Night's similar. I think M. Night is a great story guy, but his dialogue sometimes in this movie is so hard to listen to. And this scene is probably the most like blatant example of like being just kind of like, oh my God, dude, like people don't talk like this. And also, why would Cherry Jones, a capable woman, think that the only kind of capable woman that could do something would have to be an Olympian or something? It's such an odd scene.
Maybe it's also telling of the time, like the early aughts. You know, it was tough.
Luckily, the scene is saved by the kids who again deliver
a great example
of expository dialogue by saying every channel is the same on the TV, which leads us to finding out that this isn't the only place where there's a weird crop circle. They're happening everywhere, all throughout the world. It's not just the farm that our main characters are located on.
Yeah, and like all the while all this is happening, Mel Gibson's character, along with the help of his brother, are like raising children, right? And
yeah.
The children are just there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they're watching TV in the other room while they're like talking to this cop about what they've seen. And you do get a moment of Mel Gibson being a father, right, to his little girl, where I'm thirsty. And he's like, okay, here, drink this water. That water tastes funny. Like, well, what about this one? That water has dust in it. Well, what about this one? That water looks weird. Like, you go to the living room where she's watching TV and you just see 5 or 6 cups of water.
Oh God, it's so many more than that. I even wrote a note in my notes saying, how many glasses does this family own? It's a dozen.
And it's also
glasses
like,
of water.
Poor kid. Like, she's a little kid. Get her like a smaller cup of water. She can't drink a giant cup of water.
But the water matters.
The water
later
matters.
On.
Yeah,
it matters
we'll
later
come
on.
Back to that.
So I love that. So we find out that this is happening everywhere. So in order to distract the family from this weird thing that's going on, Mel Gibson's, I don't want the kids watching the TV and I don't want them listening to the radio because this is very spooky what's happening, because it's happening right in our backyard. So we're going to go on a family.
We're going to go into town.
We're going to go to the mall we're going to go downtown. It's a very small town, obviously.
Yeah, it's like
Main
Street.
Like errands, basically.
We're going to go like to Main Street and pick up some supplies and go out to eat, basically.
This segues into the funniest fucking scene in the movie. I don't know if I'm laughing at it in the sense that like it was intentionally funny or if it was funny to me on a deeper level.
Okay.
But hear me out on this because you're going to love this.
Okay.
There's a scene where after this, Joaquin Phoenix is going, he wants to join the army. He goes to go get recruited for the army.
Yeah.
And he meets with an army man who talks about how he was a famous baseball player. Joaquin Phoenix's character was a famous minor league baseball player, and how he could be getting his toes licked by the most beautiful women in the world right now. Literally what he says. I was thinking to myself as I was watching it, I was like, this scene feels like a scene from Wet Hot American Summer. The dialogue is so Hollywood sounding and fake sounding, like, how come you don't play in the big leagues there,
Sonny? She's literally talking like that.
And
the
then,
recruitment officer guy is literally talking like that and holding a mug of whatever, coffee or whatever, like up, like halfway towards his mouth. He's sitting behind a desk.
Yeah.
He can set the mug down.
Oh, it's so
but
weird.
But no, he's holding it and sitting like really upright and it's just like, wow, son.
It feels like M. Night forgot to put a scene in where we learned that he was a minor league baseball player.
You're Meryl Hess.
Yes. So then check this out, Stephanie. Then there's the cliche town bully guy that knew Meryl when they were growing up.
Of course.
And he says, well, the reason why he's not a major league baseball player is because he has the biggest number of strikeouts in the minor leagues. That's his other record. The person who delivers that line, did you catch who it was?
No, who was
Michael
it?
Michael fucking Showalter from Wet Hot American Summer.
Oh, you're fucking kidding.
The writer and star of Wet Hot American Summer. So the scene I looked it up. So the scene that feels like Wet Hot American Summer skit is literally being performed by a star of Wet Hot American. I was like,
weird.
And so I just started laughing hysterically.
Okay.
So I was like, this, now I literally feel like I'm watching Wet Hot American Summer.
That was funny.
That scene was great. I love it. Completely, like, I ended up loving that scene. So I was like, this is comedy. This is like comedy gold.
It really
to
was
me.
Comedy. You hold 3 records in the minor leagues, and then Joaquin corrects him. No, it's actually 5. But
Which
we
matters.
Don't know. Yeah,
that matters.
It matters. And then the guy, the bully, who's also signing up for the army. Okay.
And why is it Michael Showalter? It's so weird, dude. I love it. There's also another incredibly awkward comedy scene.
Yeah.
Between
at the pharmacy. Yeah.
And she's someone too.
She's known. I've seen her in, it's like a Netflix movie. I remember liking her. I'm like, oh, that girl. She's a lot younger in this, obviously.
Yeah. She's in Walking Dead also, in a season of Walking Dead.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
He's picking up a prescription. Mel Gibson's character is picking up a prescription. And she's obviously not the pharmacist because she's supposed to be like a teenager, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so too.
And again, we're told, like, hey, this is a small town where everyone knows everyone, because she greets him by his name and calls him Father Hess or Father Graham or whatever. And he has to correct her, of course. And she's, listen, I have to get something off my chest. And he just goes, okay, sure.
He so doesn't want to do it.
But he does.
And therein lies some comedic gold. And I don't know if it's intentional, but it's like there are scenes in this movie, and this is maybe the best example, where the movie is being presented like as a comedy to you. And he hardly ever plays it as a comedy. And it makes it funnier, but maybe unintentionally funnier.
I don't think Mel Gibson smiles once in the whole movie.
I don't think he ever does.
No.
And he's haunted. So this scene, she's like telling him all of her sins. She's like confessing all of these sins to him.
And they're just like, she called her boyfriend a douchebag. It's really like, you know, she's a teenager.
They're like nothing.
Yeah.
But he's just like this gaunt, haunted man staring into the camera. And you can see that he has a black heart full of grief. And something about her being all goofy and him being so like dour is like so funny to me. I don't know if I'm laughing at this in the ways that M. Night's intending me to laugh at this, but something about this is actually genuinely pretty funny.
Also, I laughed at the part where he leaves that like confessional or whatever and finds his family at the restaurant where they're meeting up to eat.
Right.
It his first thing he says to them when he sits down is like, none of you are allowed to see or hang out with this girl ever in your life, ever again.
Which is like,
because he just heard her, all of her, like, what, secrets or whatever.
And it was just like,
she said douchebag.
Right. Yeah. That scene is so funny. That's also the scene where we're introduced to an important character in the story of the movie, but not really in the actual, like, plot of the movie. M. Night. Another reason M. Night's always compared to Alfred Hitchcock is because he always has his cameo. But the difference between the two of them is he literally casts himself in his own movies.
Yeah, it was more than a cameo.
It's not just like him getting in a bus or something.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But we find out that he is the reason that Mel Gibson's wife is dead.
Yeah, he's the reason his character is a widow. It's very like bit by bit that we're discovering this backstory of this tragedy that happened. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the bigger reveals, I guess, of how it all went down, of how the wife died. We leave town and they get back home. And Morgan, so the son, Rory Culkin's character, has a baby monitor. He got this idea from the cop. In one of the earlier scenes, he was like chatting with her and she was being really sweet to him. So he was fascinated by her radio, which she had come over during one of the calls about to report this vandalism or whatever.
Sure.
So she goes, if you have one of your little sister's old baby monitors, it works the same. It just only goes one way. And he's like, okay, right on. So, of course, being the, like, rad kid he is, he's taken it upon himself to carry around this baby monitor.
Can I stop you really fast and just say, this is why I love doing this podcast with you, is I did not make that connection between those two things at all. Like, you're awesome. Sorry, keep going. You're just awesome.
I feel like this little kid has taken this, like, caretaking role in his family. He's really, like, held it down. He protects his sister. He's such a good big brother. And so he has this baby monitor in his hand, and they're all in the car, and they're coming back from town. They roll up to their house, and there's chatter, what sounds like chatter, on the baby monitor. They're all pretty alarmed by this chatter, or what sounds like chatter. The family sort of, I feel like it's like a bonding moment for them where they're all really intrigued by what they're hearing. And they want, it's that classic radio, like in and out, and you're trying to find the right signal, right? So they're moving the baby monitor around, seeing where they're going to hear this chatter the clearest. They're passing it around to one another in the car. They get out of the car. They end up climbing up onto the roof of their car and they're holding it up, and they almost end in this like Renaissance painting pose, or it almost looks like an old sculpture or something where they're all holding onto each other and the one person's holding the baby monitor up.
I liked the scene. I also, this is where I wrote down in my notes how different this movie would be with social media, if social media had been around then. I love that they're finding things out on their own and like experimenting and figuring out what's going on. And this movie works so well in this era, because if you made the same thing today, it'd be like, I went on TikTok and it's aliens.
Yeah.
You know, it would be so different. Like,
it's true. It's really mysterious. They really don't know what's happening. And it's happening in their own backyard. Whereas I feel like most people in the world, it's not like happening in their yard. So they might be less keyed into it.
Yeah.
Although it is all over the news. So that's also unlikely. But, you know, it's really close to home, literally and metaphorically.
It happening in their own backyard is where one of the things in the movie, they still at this point think it's like a prank. They don't think it's like something, like they don't think it's aliens. And you've got this prank that's happening around the world that happened in your backyard. Then you see someone on your property. They're being all weird and shady. Now you're picking up these weird signals. And for me, at this point, I'm out of there. I'm taking my kids. I've lost my wife already to a horrible accident. I think I'm taking my kids and I'm like, I'm fucking out of here. And this next thing we're going to discuss, the nighttime scene, that should really be the thing that seals the deal for them wanting to leave.
Yeah.
But let's talk about that scene now. So now it's nighttime.
Yeah.
And I fucking love this scene.
Okay. Terrifying.
It's fucking terrifying. Everyone is starting to believe that something is going on with this, with aliens, except for Mel Gibson. He's the last holdout.
Yeah.
And it ties to his character. He was a man of faith.
Yep.
He's no longer a man of faith because he lost his wife.
Yeah.
The dog that's still alive is, sorry, spoiler alert. The dog that's still alive is barking at something in the cornfields.
Yeah.
And Mel Gibson goes into the cornfield to investigate. And it is such a tense, scary scene. He realizes that he's not out there alone. There is something in the cornfield with him. We get this great subtle shot of like something watching him. And you see like its leg and a little bit of its side of its body.
Yes. You see like a gray leg.
Yes. Yeah, it's a great scene.
Yeah.
And it's super scary and super tense.
I could argue that it borderlines on like a horror movie scene where you as like the viewer almost want to yell at the character, like, why would you? Because he's like safe in his like backyard. He's feeding his dog. He hears movement in the cornfields, which is right there. So he's like, I'll grab my flashlight and investigate. And it's like, why? It's nighttime. You can't see anything. All you have is a flashlight and you're just going to walk through corn. You can't see shit in your cornfields.
Yeah.
You're going to walk through corn blindly, shine your light around.
If I'm going to play devil's advocate, the devil's advocate I'll play is maybe he so doesn't want to believe that something bigger than the world he sees around him is happening that maybe he's like trying to, maybe he's like willfully being ignorant. Like, I'm going to go out there and I'm just going to.
You're right. Because he's also like talking.
And obviously he sees something out there that changes his perspective slightly, right? And he comes back
and
to the house.
Him.
Scares the shit out of him. He comes back to the house and his reaction works because this is a movie. But if this was real life, you'd expect him to come back in the house and just be like, we're fucking out of here.
Pack your
shit.
Bags.
We're out of here. But instead he comes back in the house and he's sort of like quiet.
But also that's his character.
True. True. Is this where they start watching TV again and they start?
Yes.
Okay. So at this point, he's like, we can start watching TV again.
And it's like out in the open now that all the news is talking about aliens. And then it's just like the news anchors are just saying, this is what it seems like.
Yeah.
Are they going to be friendly?
I like the way that all of that is handled for what it's worth. I really like the way that we see the world. It's a kind of a fun movie in the sense that it's a very small personal movie about four characters going through a thing together. And it's simultaneously about a bigger thing happening throughout the world.
Yeah.
And I think they kind of balance that really nicely. The news reports feel very genuine to me. The way that the reporters talk about what's happening is like, this is how we would talk about it. They're like, we can't believe we're telling you this, but this is real footage.
Yeah.
We didn't doctor this. This is what's happening. We're seeing spacecrafts hovering over certain cities.
Yep.
This isn't a prank. This is happening. And it's scary. Stephanie and I do a really good job of not talking to each other before the podcast about the movie. But we did spoil one thing for each other in the living room. I talked about how as a kid, I was scared of like the aliens and I was scared of like them getting chased around. And as an adult, I'm more afraid of the helplessness of this situation. And for me, the scenes where they're just like, this is real and this is happening and we don't really know, you will be disturbed by this footage of just crafts hovering in the sky. That is really scary to me. Those are the scenes in this movie on a rewatch as an adult that scared me the most.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, this would be such a hopeless, helpless kind of situation.
Also, this scene is like really well shot, like really well composed. The two men are sitting on the couch with literally like their hands grabbing their knees. So like their fingers look long. Like it's ominous. Like it really conveys that feeling of what's happening. It's like kind of a dark-ish room. The lighting is low. They're lit from like the TV screen. The kids are like everyone's glued to the TV. There's no more of that father saying, kids, we shouldn't be watching this. He's all in now.
Yeah.
All in. They're glued to the TV at this point.
It might be the most, when you look at Letterboxd and you look at this movie on there, it's like the banner image for the movie. It might be the most
iconic.
Yeah, it's iconic.
Super
image.
Iconic. I agree.
This scene is also where we start to learn some really important character details.
Yes.
And we learn the actual source of the title of the movie. Because up until now,
we do.
It's been called Signs because we're thinking about the crop circles.
We are.
But the actual, the name Signs has multiple meanings. It's about the crop circles, but it's also about looking for signs, looking for, you can call them miracles, you can call them premonitions, but it's about seeing the signs of what's going on around you. I loved that.
And again, this main character, he was a preacher. He was like a man of God. It makes sense for him as a character to really go into this train of thought,
mm-hmm.
because as far as we've known, that was his old life. And now he's not a man of faith. He doesn't believe in this stuff anymore. He and his brother are sitting on the couch. The kids are asleep. And they just get into this sort of existential questioning about, like, do you believe in that there's coincidence, or that there's a reason for everything, is like the crux of their conversation, yeah. I feel.
Oh boy. So this is where the writing, this is where we want to make fun of some M. Night writing, because then this amazing monologue by Mel Gibson is then stained horribly by a terrible,
like,
monologue.
Bad.
Joaquin Phoenix's monologue is awful.
It's another expose of how horrible this character is.
Yeah, I can't stand him.
Oh my God.
So he talks about how he knows that
he believes in signs.
Why does he believe in signs, Stephanie?
He's telling a story. He's retelling an experience. He's at a party, sitting on a couch with this girl he finds to be beautiful. And he's really attracted to her. He wants to kiss her. He looks into her eyes.
I'm trying so hard not to laugh right now, dude.
So he, like, leans in to kiss her, and she starts throwing up on herself?
Yeah.
Am I missing something?
Something distracts him, and he looks away. And then in that time, she
pukes on herself.
And she would have thrown up on him if he hadn't been distracted.
He's literally like, if I had kissed her, she would have thrown up in my mouth. And it's like, dude.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Red flag.
And again, it's just one of those scenes where I'm like, is this comedy? Is he trying to write comedy? And so earlier in the podcast, we said that one of my biggest issues is, like, some of the tonal stuff.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was referring to.
And also, he's, like, laughing and smiling while he's telling the story.
Then he says he feels comforted because he was able to talk this out with his brother. And he asked Mel Gibson, which type are you? The kind that believes or the kind that doesn't? And Mel Gibson says, if you feel comforted right now, does it even matter?
Yeah.
My answer is great. Half of that scene is great. Half of that scene is a fucking catastrophe.
Oh boy.
This leads to maybe the sequence of the movie that I remember the most from my childhood.
Yeah, totally. It kind of snowballs from here.
There are two parallel running scenes at once that are both iconic in their own way. The first scene is Mel Gibson gets a phone call from M. Night's character and goes to his house.
Whose name is Ray.
And he goes to his house because he gets a call. M. Night hangs up and he goes to his house to figure out why he called.
I think we're to believe, like, it's such a small town that type of thing would warrant a house visit. I don't know.
I also think that you get the impression from the scene with Ray that Mel Gibson is just looking for any kind of acknowledgement from Ray of what happened. He's in his car outside the house, and he basically says, outside his own house, and he basically tells Mel Gibson, I've wanted to call you since the night I killed your wife.
Of the tragic accident.
The tragic accident where I killed your wife. We find out that he fell asleep at the wheel and ran into her when she was on a walk. There's more details that come out later, but that's all we know for now. And he says, I've wanted to call you. I haven't had the courage. Just now, when that thing was in my house, you were the first number I wanted to call. Then he says he's going to go toward water because he thinks the things might be injured by water. It's a little, ignore that if you can.
It's very, that he's the writer and director and producer of the movie. It's like he's the character who delivers that.
And by the way, this is an M. Night trope that M. Night always knows the most important information in his own movies.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
It's blunt and not realistic, that scene, but it felt like it was pretty effective.
To me, it's where my heart started breaking for this character, for Mel Gibson's character, oh shit, like, this was a fucking tragic, because again, we don't, as the viewer, you don't really know exactly what happened to the wife.
Not yet.
It's literally like uncovering bit by bit, you know. You know she's dead right away, then you know it was an accident. Some car accident.
Yes.
Then now we know who caused the accident. He fell asleep at the wheel. She was on a walk. So she was a pedestrian. She wasn't in a car. And you see the, like, grief on Mel Gibson's face.
Yeah.
Which you just see throughout the whole movie.
That scene in particular, though, his lip starts quivering. It's a really powerful scene. You really feel for this guy.
Yeah. And it's, like, truly devastating, you know?
Then we learn more details about the actual accident later on, and it's hard to not see it as the tragedy that it is. It's a horrible thing that happened.
Yes.
So then he goes inside the house, and, oh no, before
Up
Ray leaves. Yeah, before Ray leaves, he says, don't go into my pantry.
Yeah.
I've trapped one of them in my pantry. Okay. Quick aside here. these aliens are fucking useless. If some of a single person can trap one in the pantry, and I gotta say, I slowly start to lose the movie from this point forward.
Sure.
The aliens aren't really scary to me because they're easily defeated all the time. And the movie's more scary when it's just about ramping paranoia and tension, and not as scary when it's about them literally like confronting the aliens, in my opinion.
Yeah, because if you start, you know, and it's, that's always a problem in some, in a like monster-y movie where like, the suspense, the buildup, the not knowing is what's scary.
Exactly.
And then when things start to be like, oh, it's this, it's that,
you start to yeah.
see more.
Yeah.
And then your logical mind, or at least my like logical mind kicks in and it's okay, wait, but hang on. And you want to start asking like all the questions that
yeah.
don't necessarily get answered. Okay. And I do love this like little Easter egg. Can I say it?
Let's go.
So M. Night, he was originally born in India. His family came from India, but he didn't grow up there. When he was a baby, his family moved to Pennsylvania.
Okay. I didn't know. Oh,
this story
is in Pennsylvania.
Is set in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
The first news thing that we see about the other crop circles is in India.
Oh my
God.
And
I was like, wait,
is
this
such
a
good
point?
Is
this like a little M. Night, like little Easter egg, which I'm sure it is.
All
right,
folks, what you're going to hear next, the next audio you're going to hear is a high five. Because that is a great thing. Great Easter egg. Okay.
That was fun. I love that kind of shit, though. It's like, ooh.
All right.
I know things.
I am
smart.
I'm so glad that you revealed that to me. we're just trying to impress each other the whole time we do this. Okay, so we're back at M. Night's, Ray's house.
Yes, okay.
Where he has trapped an alien in his pantry.
At this point, like, all the beans are spilled. We know it's an alien, right? Yeah. Mel Gibson's character walks into Ray's house, goes to the pantry. I guess he's got some morbid curiosity. I don't know. And I honestly don't recall exactly how it all happens, but we see a terrifyingly inhuman hand shoot out from underneath the door of the pantry.
Right.
Mel Gibson, obviously, he's in a kitchen, right? His pantry is an offshoot of the kitchen, finds the closest available weapon to him, which happens to be a knife.
He was originally using it as a mirror to try to see the alien.
I thought that was so...
There's no fucking way it would work. Yeah.
So then, you know, obviously his first reaction is to wham, slice off the fingers of this alien.
And then he just leaves.
And then just like, well...
Doesn't call the sheriff.
Done my due diligence today.
Doesn't call the only character in the movie that we've been hanging out with the whole time that isn't in the family, the sheriff, constantly. Yeah. Okay. So this is the point for me. There's one more solid scene, and then this is the point for me where the movie kind of starts to go downhill.
Is it the Brazilian birthday party?
You better fucking believe it's the Brazilian birthday party, baby.
Okay,
that scene fucking rocks.
This is the most iconic for me.
Same here.
This is the scene that scared the shit out of me.
Yep.
And maybe it's because it's like that found footage feeling.
Yeah.
Where it feels so real that it makes it more scary.
Yeah.
Which, if you haven't seen the movie, you're missing out. Just YouTube search the Brazilian birthday party scene from Signs.
Parallel to the scene that we were just describing with Mel Gibson in the pantry, Joaquin Phoenix is watching a news report where they have finally gotten footage of one of the entities, and it's shown through the footage of birthday party footage from Brazil, a little kid's birthday party.
Yep.
And it's just, it's the fact that it isn't like a monster jumping toward the camera and going, blah!
No.
But it's so subtle. It's just the monster just kind of walks by and they film it as it walks by.
The kids, it shows the kids at this party staring out the window and they're like, what is it? What's happening? And shout out, woo, Brazil, Nina represent.
Oh yeah, Nina, our editor, we love you. Yeah, bye Brazil.
And they're like looking out the window and there's something happening and then they run over to this other window and the camera's following the kids. They're all in a flurry and the camera pans to look out the window and there's like a bush, and out from behind this bush comes the alien. He stops and looks at the kids in the window and keeps walking.
It's really scary.
Terrifying. The news is showing us this and they're like rewinding and playing and pausing like on the alien. It's scary.
From this point forward, the movie kind of takes a turn and it becomes about, it stops being about what's going on in the world and it starts to be about what's going on with this family. Shortly after this, they lose the signal. They're no longer getting a signal from the news on the TV about what's going on in the world. And which to me, I told you earlier, is the scariest part of the whole movie for me, is when they try to turn the TV on and there's no more signal on the TV. And the movie now becomes about them barricading themselves in the house.
Yep.
And preparing for an imminent attack.
Yeah.
But at this point in the movie, it becomes about a family going through a thing. And it no longer is really about what's happening outside of this house. Unfortunately, that also means for you and I in our podcast, the corn vanishes from the movie at this point. There's no more cornfields. It's very sad.
It is pretty tragic. It's there. We know it's there.
In our hearts, we know it's there.
Yeah.
There's a comedic scene of Joaquin Phoenix and Mel Gibson trying to hammer boards, which they don't know. Apparently, they've never used a hammer.
They've never held a hammer. They've never had to hammer a nail.
And they leave a fucking dog outside the house. Our second dog casualty of the movie
happened.
It's awful. And you know what? It's unrealistic. And I don't think that M. Night owns a dog because you wouldn't do, a family wouldn't do this to their dog. But
also,
they lost the dog outside.
Suddenly the alien is like actively hunting them, which is interesting to me.
So this is where I like the little twist of the movie. The little twist of the movie we kind of learn around this time. It's not an invasion. It's a raid. They're not invading the Earth. They are taking people. They're plucking people away. So it explains some things that I was critiquing earlier. Why they would go to the small farm, for example, and not go straight into Philadelphia. The movie makes a point to show how close to Philadelphia the farm is.
Right.
But it's a red herring. They're really just going to this farm because they want to, for whatever, we don't ever learn why, but they're raiding areas. They're stealing people, which I kind of like.
Yeah. Yes. I do too.
Yeah. There's one more human scene before the action really kicks off of them all making their dream meal as a family.
Which,
they all make their favorite meals and they sit around and he's upset with them for not enjoying their meals.
Yeah.
He's obviously the one who's going through the actual panic, not them. And he gets mad and says, and Rory Culkin says to Mel Gibson, "I hate you." And he says something like, "That's fine." The way he reacts is so, and to me, it's a metaphor of Mel Gibson feels that way about God. Mel Gibson hates God because God took his wife and he hates God. And God is kind of like, I'm not trying to get religious here. This is the theme of the movie, but God is kind of like, that's fine. You can hate me. I'm still going to be blank. I'm still going to show up in your life in one way or another. Right. And I liked, and then they all hug and embrace.
Yeah, they all hug.
It's a nice little scene.
It's sweet.
Before the movie seriously devolves into kind of nonsense. From this point forward, I start not liking signs as much.
Okay, so then we really find out what happened to the wife. Like, we learn through the eyes of Mel Gibson's character. He shows up on the scene. The cop, the sheriff, who we know, stops him and is like, "Hey, it's really bad. Like, she's alive right now, but only because she's pinned in such a way. She's been crashed by a car into a tree, and she's pinned in such a way that she's, like, able to be alive, and she's, like, kind of talking, but there's no hope.
She's going to die.
It's fatal. She's fatally wounded.
And she literally says, "This is the last conversation you're going to have with your wife."
Oh my God, how tragic.
It's honestly, like, again, as an adult, watching this movie as an adult versus as a kid, it's the only part of the movie that I had trouble watching.
I did too.
It's so sad and it's so scary.
So anyways, he goes and he's talking to his wife. And she knows she's dying, so she's giving her last words or whatever to him.
Right.
And she gives him messages, like, for their children.
Mm-hmm.
And
one of them is for Rory Culkin to look out for his sister forever, which is why he's so protective.
Yes.
It pays off.
And one of them is for Meryl.
Yes.
Joaquin Phoenix's character.
Right.
Which, like, kind of saves the day.
Yeah, yeah.
So she tells Mel Gibson to tell Meryl to, I quote, "Swing away, Meryl."
Yeah, because he was a minor league baseball player, as we said earlier. So swing away. It comes back later on. The rest of the movie, the next like 30 or so minutes of the movie, is them barricading themselves inside the house and the aliens trying to break into the house to get them.
Mm-hmm.
It's at times it's nice and tense. At times I wasn't as into it. It's shot really well. The best parts of this movie are when they're not flat out showing you things and they're showing you like, and you're hearing things in the background or it's dark. I like those parts the best. Rory Culkin has an asthma attack in the attic or in the basement.
Yeah.
His medicine is not in there with them.
Yeah, they don't have his inhaler.
So there's this great scene of Mel Gibson trying to get him to breathe. It's really powerful. It's very scary. And as that scene ends and the next scene begins, the radios are back on. The aliens are leaving. They're leaving. People have died.
Yeah, but they're retreating.
They're retreating.
But like, huh?
Somehow we figured out how to beat them, but they don't say on the news.
No.
And Mel Gibson realizes this might be the window he needs to go get his son's medicine to help with his asthma.
So, yeah, because he was able to calm him down or help his breathing, but he was unconscious, right?
It's a temporary fix.
Unconscious,
yeah,
too.
It's a temporary fix. He if he doesn't get help soon, he will
help.
Die.
Yeah.
Oh boy. This enters from this point forward. I'm just going to be completely blunt with you. I hated this movie from this point forward.
Really?
I did. I hated this
movie.
So from this point forward, Mel Gibson and Joaquin Phoenix and the whole family leave the basement, assuming the aliens have left to get Rory Culkin his medicine.
They walk into their living room where the TV is. The TV, there's nothing showing. It's like static, right?
It's not even on. You just see the reflection of the room through the TV.
Okay, so they see, he looks into his TV. He sees a reflection. In the reflection, jump scare, alien.
There's an alien.
In the room.
And if they had only shown it through things like reflections and stuff, it probably would have been fine for me.
I know, but then they turn around and we see alien.
And the alien is bad CGI that's aged poorly and it's really fuzzy.
It's creepy.
I do think it's creepy, and he's holding Rory Culkin.
The kid.
He's holding Rory Culkin. It is scary. He sprays.
Ew, this like thing shoots out of his wrist, and there's like fumes.
Toxic
in it.
Gas that he sprays into Rory Culkin's face.
Yeah.
And then Mel Gibson
turns his head and looks to his brother Merrill, and happens to see on the wall, conveniently located right next to where Merrill's standing.
It was a premonition. It was meant to happen. There are no It was a sign, Stephanie. It's a sign. It's not a coincidence.
There is a bat.
His baseball bat from when he was in the minor leagues.
Mounted on the wall, right within grabbing distance of Merrill.
And what does he say to Merrill?
And he says, "Swing away, Merrill."
And boy, oh boy, does Merrill swing away.
Merrill swing away.
The alien, this is why I hated this. I don't mind the premonition, and I don't mind it all coming back on itself. All of that's fine with me. What I don't like is I think the alien has aged poorly in terms of how it looks, and I don't like that the alien stands there like an NPC from a video game and doesn't do anything and just lets Joaquin Phoenix beat the shit out of it. Also, it's the same alien that Mel Gibson encountered earlier in the movie.
Yes.
Because it's missing fingers.
We see the alien's hand.
It would have been enough to just show the hand with the missing fingers. They also just go out of their way to show us a flashback of him cutting the fingers off, which really pissed me off.
That just happened.
Yeah, it literally just happened.
We don't need that.
So he beats the shit out of the alien with a baseball bat. And while doing so, what happens?
He happens to knock over one of the, two dozen at this point,
at
cups
least.
Of water sitting around the house left over by little Abigail Breslin's character.
And what's the alien's weakness?
Water.
The alien's weakness is water.
It burns their skin.
Okay, now listen. Before you dickheads listening to the podcast, you cynical dickheads, want to bash the... before you start bashing this movie and saying, why would they go to a planet covered in water? Listen, at the end of the day, the alien invasion in this movie is not the point of this movie. This movie is about purpose and faith. It's about what do you do when the only thing you've ever believed in fails you, and then you're confronted with something even worse. So I don't care that I don't care that the aliens are, that water hurts the aliens. I don't even care because the movie isn't about an alien invasion. If it was an action movie where at the end of the movie they figured out.
Then you're like,
that doesn't bother me because the movie isn't about that. The movie is about overcoming grief. And reclaiming your belief in what grounds you as a person. So I don't know. A lot of people online bash the water angle. I don't love it. It's kind of stupid.
It's pretty stupid.
But I also don't think it's worth being like, this movie sucks because of that.
No. I wouldn't write off the entire thing.
And listen, people listening to the podcast, you're not cynical dickheads. I was just fired up. Unless you are, but maybe you're not. I was just fired up. While this is happening, Mel Gibson runs Rory Culkin outside. And this is actually one of the things I like in the finale is, he's convinced that because Rory Culkin was having such a bad asthma attack.
Right, so his throat is closed up, essentially. That's like asthma is inflammation, so you can't breathe.
So he didn't breathe in the fumes, and he's going to be okay.
He's going to be okay.
And there's a real moment where you think he's not going to be.
Yeah.
And the acting there is stellar.
Yeah.
Everyone just knocks out of the park.
Agree.
Joaquin Phoenix is great. They all look like they're so sad, and he lives. And he regains his faith, and that should be the end of the movie.
Agreed.
Except...
Damn, they should have ended
there's
it right
one there. Completely unnecessary scene where we see Mel Gibson wear a priest's outfit.
It's a little too, like,
A little.
In your face.
It's the most ham-fisted bullshit on the planet. I hated the very ending of the movie is awful. but it's not enough to
ruin the
whole thing.
He's like buttoning up the shirt with the collar back on, like all fatherly again.
It doesn't matter. It's so weird. But hey, that's Signs. We did it. We talked about the whole movie. And I want to talk a little bit about a subject that you've been really clamoring to talk about on the podcast.
Okay.
I want to talk about 9/11.
Ooh, yeah.
So could Signs exist without 9/11?
Is this a trick question?
I think in the state that it's in the state that we got it in, I don't think that Signs could happen if 9/11 hadn't happened. Signs is the most 2000, so it came out in 2002. It's the most 2002 movie on the planet. It's all about a very kind of ambiguously American family that is invaded on their own soil by a foreign entity that they don't quite understand. And as a result of that, they struggle with faith and they struggle with paranoia and isolation. And to me, the whole movie, to me, the entire time I was watching it, I was just like, oh my God, this is such a early 2000s, 9/11 just happened movie. It's hard for me to separate the two.
Yeah. Wow. When you put it that way. It rings true. I mean, but I wonder, it came out mid-02. That's not that, like, this. It was probably written before the events.
I'm not sure. I didn't do enough. I did, like, the smallest amount of research, so I don't really know, like, when it went into production or anything like that. Maybe it's just one of those things where the timing was perfect, but...
Right.
But I can understand how people... The movie's a little polarizing. I don't think everyone loves this. I don't think everyone hates this. But I can see how people connected with it when it came out. Because it's very much a product of its time.
Yeah.
How do you feel about M. Night? Do you like M. Night? Are you a fan of his movies?
M. Night, I haven't seen a ton of his movies. The Sixth Sense, obviously.
Yeah, what have you seen? Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense.
Signs.
Signs.
Have you seen Unbreakable?
Yes.
Okay.
And Lady in the Water.
Same. Really bad.
No, not good.
So bad.
Gosh. And then a lot of his like newer ones, I didn't appeal to me. So I didn't go and see. I did appreciate reading a little bit about him and like his background. And I'm sure every director has a story like that where they've loved movies and filmmaking from an early age and this and that. But how he was gifted a camera really young and made like home movies and whatever, and how in a lot of his DVD releases, starting with The Sixth Sense, he included scenes from his home movies as like a testament to like this is like my whatever.
Yeah, I didn't know that. That's
yeah,
cool.
I thought it was fun. I don't know. I'm kind of just like whatevs about him. I feel like the thing in my mind that stands out the most when I think of M. Night is like the M. Night Shyamalan twist.
Right.
Right.
And ironically, this movie doesn't have a twist. Which is fine.
I'm
totally okay with it, but it doesn't have a twist.
Twists can be overrated.
So M. Night for me, yeah, I have a similar sentiment to him. So I saw The Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, Signs, The Village, all in a row, and Lady in the Water all in a row. Two of them I saw in theaters. I saw The Village and Lady in the Water in theaters. The other three I saw right when they came out. So I was really into him early on. This to me, Signs, this for me is the turning point in his career where he's starting to get more schlocky and schmaltzy. And The Village and Lady in the Water both suffer from that for me a little bit.
Yeah, so he's coming off like some big hits and a lot of success.
Yeah.
When he's making this movie. For
Sixth
sure.
Sense and Unbreakable are both kind of fun movies. I like them both. I haven't seen them in a long time. I remember liking them. I have seen The Happening, which is so bad it's good.
Okay.
And then I haven't seen anything since The Happening.
Yeah.
But he falls in this very interesting category as a director for me. And maybe you have other things like this in your life too, where every time a movie of his comes out, I always go on Wikipedia and read about the movie. Because I think he's interesting. And you said something really sharp earlier, which I didn't acknowledge then that I should have, which is he makes original things.
Yeah.
He could be making Marvel movies. Same here. Good for him. He did make the last Airbender movie, which is a horrible fucking nightmare. But for the most part, he makes semi-original kind of unique ideas. And I think I do respect him for doing that. Overall, impressions of Signs. What did you think?
Overall, I liked it.
Yeah.
I liked it. I thought it was, I've already said this, I thought it was fun because it was original. There are certain elements of it I really liked. I thought it was like this, I kind of liked the set design. I liked their house. I liked the farm they were on. I really loved the kid acting, like child acting. Like we've said again, Children of the Corn.
Real bad.
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 This one,
for the most part,
they were pretty good. And it was good. Well, I don't know. I read this like critic review that I can definitely relate to, of where people praised like the cinematography, people praised the atmosphere, the score, the story. But one of the more highly criticized things was the script.
Yeah.
Which
I think that's fair.
Yeah. I think that's fair too.
I agree. I liked it too. I think that its problems don't outweigh the things about it that are good. And ultimately, I think if you view it as a personal story about a family, it's a better movie than if you view it as a movie about an alien invasion.
For sure.
You said some reviews. Can I read some reviews I found
Please
on Letterboxd? I went through Letterboxd. And by the way, if you have a Letterboxd and you're listening to this podcast, I go through the most recent reviews of a movie and I read them on the podcast. But I only find the ones I like. So it has to be a good one. You better be funny. here's some reviews.
Okay.
M. Whitaker says his best comedy. Pirate 69. I was entertained like the whole time. I liked it a lot, and I love the aliens with all that corn. Even watch it again. Pirate 69.
You're our biggest fan.
Listen to the podcast. I'm gonna write to all of these people on Letterboxd, let them know we're reading their
Please
reviews,
do.
By the way. The Big D 2003 says the aliens looked like my friend Alex Smith.
Oh, poor Alex.
Sorry, Alex.
Or maybe not.
Maybe not.
Who knows?
And my last review I'll read here. Will Ralston says, for a house with a Culkin in it, they were horribly prepared for intruders.
That's a good one. Hey, so to sort of wrap things up, at the end of every show, we like to do our corn rating.
Yes, we do.
After all, this is a podcast about movies that have corn in it.
That's right.
So our rating system is based on a scale of 5.
Yeah, 1 through 5 cobs.
Corn on the cob. So what do you give it on your corn rating?
I'm going to give it a 3 out of 5 cobs.
Okay.
The first, two-thirds feature corn in a very prominent role. I think two of the scariest scenes take place in the cornfields. And the catalyst of the whole plot of the movie...
Literally took the words out of my mouth.
...is a sign in a cornfield. I am going to give it 3 out of 5, a decent score. It's no okay. Children of the Corn.
Yeah. I will say I give it a little higher of a rating. I give it a 4 out of 5.
Wow.
I'm pretty generous.
You are
when
generous.
When it comes to rating. But because to me, and you literally just said it, the scariest parts to me took place in a cornfield. It
yep.
involved corn.
Yep.
The catalyst was the corn, was the signs, was the crop circles. And some of those scenes genuinely scared me.
Oh,
so
yeah, for sure.
That was exciting.
Hey, either way you look at it, 3 out of 5 or 4 out of 5, Signs gets a pretty good cob rating. I think that we can say I would recommend Signs.
I would recommend for sure.
Well, hey, thanks for listening. This has been Pod on the Cob. I should probably know the name of our podcast.
Maybe.
Pod on the Cob. If you want to reach us and suggest any movies or just give us your feedback, you can reach out to podonthecob@gmail.com. And also by the time this comes out, we will also have an Instagram. Just look up Pod on the Cob and you'll find our Instagram. But we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a story about, your first watch of Signs or your first watch of Children of the Corn or any of the movies that we're going to discuss, we'd love to hear it. That's a fun part for us, is talking about the things that or the nostalgia that goes along with these movies. So again, thanks for listening. My name's Stephanie.
And I'm Tyler.
And this was Pod on the Cob.
Have a wonderful afternoon.
Peace out.